As you guys are aware, my presentation for today is called Decolonizing Universalism. To give you a little bit of a sense of what I'm going to do in the talk, I want to start out by letting you know that what you're about to see is effectively a summary of the arguments in a forthcoming book. The book is called Decolonizing Universalism and will come out with Oxford in the fall. Because the book, I'm giving sort of a summary of the book, I just want to warn you guys that the arguments I'm about to put forward are a bit schematic. I want to encourage you, though, to press me on details about any of them in the question and answer period, if you would like. So effectively, how I see the project of the book is as intervening to move us beyond an impasse that has come to exist in debates about the role of normativity in transnational and decolonial feminisms. Effectively, I think the impasse is caused by something that I'm referring to as the anti-imperialism normativity dilemma. This dilemma basically suggests that we have a choice between two positions. One position which eschews imperialism, but then gives up on the idea that feminism is a normative doctrine, and another position that defends moral universalism and kind of says, well, if this requires feminists to be imperialists, then so be it. So my interest is in kind of moving us beyond this debate. The way I think that, to move us beyond the debate is to stop admitting or to stop conceding the thing that both sides of this debate tacitly agree on, which is that I take them to be tacitly agreeing on the idea that the normative commitments that are central to feminism are the same normative commitments that play a causal role in justifying imperialism. So what I attempt to do in the book is to, oh look, I do have some animations. This got switched from Keynote to PowerPoint, so you know how that can involve some strange technological mishaps. But so my solution to this debate, as I have said, is to try to show that the normative commitments that are central to feminism are not, in fact, the same ones that encourage imperialist intervention. So I try to do this in two ways, both of which are parts of my developing this perspective that I refer to as non-ideal universalism. So the first thing I try to do, so the first reason that I have here that the normative commitments, that feminism's being a normative doctrine is not itself what causes imperialism, is that I distinguish the precise normative commitments that I take to be imperialism motivating from the central normative commitments of feminism. So I concede to several people in the anti-imperialist literature that certain normative commitments that people associate with feminism are in fact imperialism justifying, but then I go on to say that those normative commitments are not the core normative commitments of feminism. The second thing, the second kind of reason that I am able to distinguish the normative commitments that are imperialism causing from the ones that are central to feminism is by claiming that missionary feminism, which is the name that I give to the kind of bad imperialist feminism I'm trying to criticize, is not just mistaken about the content of feminism's normative commitments, but is mistaken about the type of normative commitments that feminism requires. So they mistakenly think that a certain type of normative ideal is the only possible normative ideal. So I'm going to, for reasons of time, I'm going to skip the examples of feminist complicity and imperialism and come back to them. And I am just going to give you a little bit of a roadmap for the rest of the talk. So I'm going to basically do four things, really. The first thing is that I'm going to describe my view of what the normative content of feminism is. And that view is non-ideal universalism. So I'm going to describe my positive view. And then I'm going to talk about how non-ideal universalism helps us move beyond three important debates about the role of normative concepts in feminism. And they are, in particular, a debate about whether feminism requires commitment to individualism. The second debate is a debate whether feminism requires commitments to certain types of autonomy and secularism. And the third debate is about whether feminism requires what Laila Abu-Ghad refers to as saving two, which is the idea of a culturally specific end state as the normative model that all societies should follow. And my answer, as I'm sure you can preview to all three of the debates, is going to effectively be no, that feminism does not require any of these things and can maintain its status as a normative doctrine in spite of not requiring any of these positions. So, as I mentioned, the first thing I'm going to do is to say a little bit about what my positive view that I describe as non-ideal universalism is. So non-ideal universalism combines two different views. One is a view about what the normative content of feminism is, and one is a view about the role or about the types of concepts that transnational feminist praxis requires. So to begin with the part of the view that is a description of the normative content of feminism, I take feminism definitionally to be opposition to sexist oppression. I'm not going to say very much in defense of this particular view, except that I think it is relatively non-controversial among feminists, although if people want to ask me about why I have not included other oppressions in the definition, I'm happy to speak about my reasons for that in the Q&A. Of course, to operationalize this definition, we need an understanding of what oppression is, and the definition I'm working with is the one from Marilyn Frye's classic article from the 80s, wherein oppression is used to describe a set of social arrangements in which some social groups are systematically disadvantaged so that other social groups can benefit. So what's opposition to sexist oppression? Well, it's opposition to a type of social structure in which some members of some genders are disadvantaged over others. Typically, men are advantaged over women. The view about the role of normative concepts in transnational feminist praxis that is a part of non-ideal universalism is that I take transnational feminist praxis to be a non-ideal praxis in the sense, especially, I mean, I know this term has various uses in political philosophy right now. I borrow most heavily from the work of Amartya Sen and my colleague Charles Mills here. The basic idea that I have is that theorizing about transnational feminisms is a justice-enhancing rather than a justice-achieving praxis. Or to use Mills' terms, it's a praxis that is focused on trying to rectify or reduce existing injustice rather than posit an ideal of what perfect justice looks like. So what I think that non-ideal universalism lets us do to the anti-imperialism normativity dilemma is it allows us to say kind of two things. One is, let's look back at the values that missionary feminists are promoting as necessary for feminism and find out whether they are conceptually related to the end of sexist oppression. And second, my views about the role of transnational the role of normative concepts in transnational feminist praxis allow us to criticize certain types of ideals for actually failing at being justice enhancing and being imperialism promoting instead. So with that said, I will get into discussing the kind of three specific debates that I think non-ideal universalism helps us make progress in. So the first debate is a debate about whether feminists need to be individualists. So what we have in the debate about anti-imperialist feminism and individualism is effectively one side, the anti-imperialist side, associating various harms to women with individualism, claiming in particular that certain interventions that are conducted with imperialist motives into other women's lives are harmful to them. And then we have from the other side of the debate, which is kind of occupied by both missionary feminists and liberal feminists who would not necessarily avow all of missionary feminism, saying that, feminists have to be some kind of individualists, because if we aren't individualists of some kind, then we are in support of treating groups as more valuable than individual women, and surely feminism requires support for treating individual women's needs and interests as distinguishable and important. So what I attempt to do in the book to make some progress in this debate is partly to begin to raise the question of whether the form of individualism that the anti-imperialist feminists are criticizing is identical with a form that's necessary for feminism. And what I end up concluding are kind of two different things. First, I end up deciding that the value that the anti-imperialist feminists are criticizing is in fact a form of individualism, but it is one that is not necessary that's not conceptually related to feminism. And in fact, further, I end up going on to say that in fact, even the form of individualism that missionary and liberal feminists often say they're defending, that it is also not conceptually related to feminism. So to explain a little bit about how I got there, I'll begin first with explaining what I take the form of individualism the anti-imperialist feminists are criticizing to be. And I should be clear for folks who are not immersed in this literature, most of the people who are engaged in the anti-imperialist side of this debate are not philosophers. They are, in fact, social scientists who are analyzing specific cases of harm to other women. And as a result, part of what my task is in understanding their critique is to try to bring some kind of sophisticated normative distinctions to what they're talking about, and to try to figure out precisely what is the harm that they are worried about and what is the source of the harm that they're worried about. So they basically describe four types of harms. And I give a taxonomy of them in the book, and I divide them into these four types. Neoliberal governmentality harms, feminization of responsibility harms, kinship harms, and cultural harms. So very briefly, and this is the only one I'm going to describe in detail, neoliberal governmentality harms are harms to individual women that come about as a result of the weakening of associations that exert a protective force in their lives. And this often happens through encouraging them to participate in a capitalist economy. The reason it's a form of individualism is that both that it encourages a weakening of a certain type of communal bond, and that it comes about often through encouraging people to think of their interests as separate from and in competition with the interests of other people in their communities. So to give a quick example of this, I take this to be central to what Lamia Karim's critique of microcredit is. Effectively, what she says is that before the advent of microcredit, women in rural Bangladesh, like the poor in many areas of the world, are heavily dependent on one another for survival. They lend money and food to each other in lean times, and also share dependency work and housework with each other. And the worry is that after the advent of microcredit, women come to see the other people in their communities as potential sources of income or competitors. And then given that microcredit does not, there's not evidence showing that it ends their poverty, women are often worse off once this has happened because they're not brought out of poverty, and yet they lack the assistance with dependency work and access to resources that they used to have because of these communal associations. So this is what I have in mind as a neoliberal governmentality harm. Feminization of responsibility harms occur when development interventions that encourage women to focus on earning an individual income end up having, and this is a term from Sylvia Chan's work, end up having the effect of increasing women's gendered labor burdens without increasing their negotiating power. Kinship harms happen when changes in kinship structures increase women's subjection to vulnerability and gendered vulnerability. And finally, cultural harms, which are the ones that are most theorized about in the philosophical literature, are harms to individual women that occur as a result of the destruction of cultural attachments or through the production of cultural stigma. So as I said, I'm not going to go into depth about all of the harms, but here's what I think all of them have in common. So all of them have in common being harms to individual women that are caused by interventions and projects designed by people who fail to recognize the value in women's lives that is imported by their existing attachments. So I want to make two kind of logical qualifying remarks about what I see as going wrong here. One is that when I point out that they're harms, I want to be very clear that they are harms to individual women, and that I'm pointing that out to avoid being question begging about issues about whether groups or individuals have some kind of fundamental moral primacy. The harms that I have just described are likely to be perceived as harms by people regardless of kind of what their underlying moral worldview is about the importance of individuals versus groups. So I'm deliberately sort of theoretically agnostic about what specific moral ontology you have to have to see the harms as harms. Second, when I say that these interventions fail to recognize the value that existing attachments import to women's lives, I want to be clear that I take the value to be a contribution to objective well-being and not just subjective well-being. So I'm always saying this because I wrote a book about adaptive preferences, but when I say that the value that the attachments import to women's lives is not being recognized, I emphatically do not mean that the fact that women value these attachments is overlooked. I mean the contributions to objective well-being brought about by these attachments is being overlooked. So, I think as I have the power, one version of these notes, I want to make sure that I'm up to date here. Okay. Let's go back. Okay. Finally, trying to excavate the value that was promoting these interventions, I came to see the interventions as motivated by a combination of two views that I will together refer to as independence individualism. And independence individualism effectively is a combination of two views, and also this is defined on your handout. It's a combination of the view that individual economic self-sufficiency is valuable, and the view that only chosen relationships have value. And I mentioned, and we can talk about this in the Q&A if you guys want, chosenness seems to actually be functioning in the justifications of the interventions as a type of racial dog whistle where attachments that are associated with non-white cultural others are automatically cast as unchosen. And the attachments that people have in kind of Western post-industrial societies are all viewed as chosen. Okay. So part of the puzzle for me is to try to understand why missionary feminists would think that this form of individualism is related to feminism. And in fact, they seem to think more than that this form of individualism is related to feminism. They seem to think that what the anti-imperialists are describing as harms are in fact benefits. So there's kind of a strange puzzle here where the same policy motivated by a certain set of values is viewed by one group of people as causing harm and viewed by another group of people as beneficial. So in trying to wrap my head around why, I came to think that why people thought that independence individualism was related to feminism was because of a conflation of two types of individualism. So I say that it is caused by a conflation between personhood individualism and what I've called independence individualism. So I'm going to give two examples of that in a minute, but I want to point out that my move here is going to be to say two things. One, independence individualism is not the only way or even a way necessarily to express value for personhood individualism. And then second, I'm going to say, and this is maybe the more controversial move, that I'm not even sure that personhood individualism is conceptually related to feminism. So personhood individualism, as I'm describing it, is the view that persons have separate interests and moral worth. It's, you might want to call it normative individualism, which is, of course, a name by which this view often goes in philosophy. I just want to be a little bit conservative about using that term because the term normative individualism is often taken to entail much more than this, including often the belief that the individual human being is the sole locus of normativity in the world. I don't think that that's really what feminists are worried about when they conflate personhood and independence individualism. I just have these two quotations to try to give you some examples. One is from your own country about forced marriage laws, but that are of designers of the interventions effectively claiming that providing economic independence and chosen relationships is the way of respecting that women are human beings. So to give one example from the literature about modernization theory and Naila Kabir's summary of it, which is the theory behind the prevailing women in development paradigm, you often hear arguments that making women able to earn an income will make them start questioning their customs and in turn make them stop being men's beast of burden, so stop being instruments for men. Similarly, the second quotation is from the UK Home Secretary's defense of a law that was ostensibly prohibiting forced marriage but was overturned for being discriminatory, in which he says that effectively that respecting people's individual dignity requires allowing them to be able to become economically independent citizens. So, I think I have said a little bit about what independent individualism is and why it shouldn't be conflated with personhood individualism. I want to say a little bit about why it seems plausible for personhood individualism to have anything to do, or independence individualism to have anything to do with feminism in the first place. And I think the short answer, because if you look at the two pieces of personhood individualism, they're not conceptually related to each other. I think the appeal of this value comes from essentially a familiar narrative about modernization in the West that effectively says that the advent of capitalism coincides with people's ability to criticize tradition, which itself coincides with moral progress. It also may be associated with the extrapolation from a very limited data set about what allows women to enhance their autonomy. It is true to some extent that in very specific social circumstances, being able to earn an income helps women detach themselves from abusive relationships. But this, I think, is a highly context-specific and contingent claim. It may be true in the types of, in more communal societies, for example, that being absorbed into another collective is actually a better way to escape an abusive relationship than to be able to go out and economically strike out on one's own. I'm gonna skip a little piece of this. The final thing I want to say about whether feminism requires any form of individualism is just to quickly point out that I think thinking that even personhood individualism is required for feminism is a type of category error. To give the 2-second explanation of why, oppression is a relationship that obtains between or among social groups. So it's not clear on its own why value for the individual person has to be a part of feminism in every context. Now, of course, in situations where counting as an individual is a currency of advantage or disadvantage, and that's already the case, then there is a warrant for feminists to care about personhood individualism. But if counting as a separate individual is not already a currency of advantage and disadvantage, feminism on its own does not require value for for personhood individualism. Okay. So I'm going to skip this, and I'm going to move us into the second debate. So the second debate that I think non-ideal universalism helps us resolve is a debate about whether feminists should value something I'm referring to as anti-traditionalist autonomy. So the value that is criticized frequently in anti-imperialist feminisms, especially in the literature about Muslim women, is a value that gets variously referred to as freedom, autonomy, and secularism. Effectively, we see this argument at work, especially in claims, for example, that were frequent during the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, that said, for example, that the destruction of Islam is actually a benefit to women. It also comes up frequently in arguments that women need to be able to criticize religion in order for any kind of feminist change to happen. So I think these arguments are relatively familiar. They're being used against cultural minorities and Muslims in particular, I think is also very common. I have this quotation from Elizabeth Bodenter's defense of the hijab ban in public schools here. Without going into too much detail about it, what she seems to suggest is that even being reminded that some people wear hijabs when you go to public school will infringe on your freedom, and that on its own is a feminist concern. So to kind of get to the heart of the, of the value that's being described here, I want to describe it as anti-traditionalist autonomy to be clear that it's not a form of autonomy that is frequently described in the philosophical literature on autonomy. Basically, but I do take it to be very popularly motivating public discourse, whether it's a part of the philosophical literature on autonomy or not. And the basic idea in this value, or basic idea in the value of anti-traditionalist autonomy, is that being that what autonomy entails is the ability to distance oneself from inherited dictates, and that a person should be able to distance themselves from every inherited dictate and to ask themselves whether that dictate ought to be normative for them. So, as in other, actually I'm gonna skip some of this. I just wanna point out, this book has been hugely influential, but it depends on kind of what audience I'm talking to. Is anyone familiar with Saba Mahmood's work in the audience? Okay, one, two people. It doesn't matter, but just so you know, this book is like, if you go into an interdisciplinary women's studies audience and tell them that you're talking about this book, everyone will say that they have read it. The key kind of philosophical takeaway, I think, from Saba Mahmood's book is she points out, look, values for freedom and autonomy are playing all these roles in imperialism. One of the things that I am specifically concerned about, although she would never put it this way because she's an anthropologist, is respect for a type of worldview that the participants in my ethnography have. What type of worldview do they have? They have a worldview that I describe as metaphysically traditionalist, and that's a worldview according to which it's kind of familiar to us maybe as an Aristotelian type of worldview, where one cannot understand the meaning of certain normative dictates unless one practices them without questioning them. The women in her sample, for example, say, you don't know what modesty is until you start wearing a veil. And then once you start wearing a veil, you internalize the value of modesty and come to understand what it is. So, to briefly say a little bit about why I don't think anti-traditionalist autonomy is necessary for feminism, I want to point out that the defenders of anti-traditionalist autonomy effectively think that feminism is a byproduct of a certain type of crude liberalism. And I think that their reasoning is something like this. Oppressive practices are often defended on the grounds that they are traditional. Therefore, in order to criticize oppressive practices, we need the ability to criticize tradition and ask ourselves whether it should be normative for us. Now, I think that this is just false. The reason I think that it's false, I mean, this is on your handout, I think it's both insufficient for feminism because plenty of oppressive practices are not traditional, right? So the example I use in the paper is that the expectation that women conform their sexual desires and appearances to pornography is not traditional, but is sexist. But more importantly, I think the relationship here is also unnecessary. The short version of why I think the relationship between feminism and anti-traditionalist autonomy is unnecessary is simply that what I have here, which is that oppressiveness is a feature of the effects of practices and not of their origins. So if that's right, it's possible to believe that oppression is bad and wrong because one takes a tradition as normative. And in fact, I take that to be what many Islamic feminists are actually doing. So many of them are actually arguing something like, the will of God is unquestionably normative for us. Fortunately, the will of God happens to be that gender equality is important. So a great example is Amina Wadud's work, in which she is famous for being a metaphysical traditionalist, at least in her early work, kind of saying, you don't get to question what the Quran says if you're a Muslim. But then her argument is, but the Quran says that shirk, meaning making yourself unequal to God, is like one of the worst kinds of immorality that you can have, and patriarchy is a form of shirk. It involves men saying that they are on a par with God and that women are below them. So the final debate that I want to say that non-ideal universalism can help us move beyond is not one about the specific normative content of feminism, as in which values feminists ought to endorse, but it is instead a debate about the type of normative concepts feminists use. And I describe it kind of borrowing words from Laila Abu-Lughod, as a debate about whether feminists need to have an idea of what they are saving women to. So Abu-Lughod's also kind of classic essay is a reflection on the US invasion of Afghanistan, in which she basically asks, how is it that all these people who say that they're feminists are now, you know, in favor of the US bombing countries ostensibly to save women? And part of her answer is that they are people who believe that Western culture is the solution for women, and that what is entailed in saving, which she thinks is the bad way to be a feminist, is having an idea not just that something is wrong in someone's life, but that they ought to be saved to something else. So I was interested in kind of trying to parse out what the saving to mentality is. So I think kind of the obvious answer is, yes, it's partly ethnocentrism, right? Like, part of your idea of how everyone is going to be saved by stopping veiling and stopping focusing on God is probably a type of Western ethnocentrism. But I think there's also more going on here. And in particular, I think the person who is in favor of saving too has a very specific type of moral ideal in mind. They think that in order to have any moral ideal, the moral ideal must be of a certain type. And that type is both a thick culturally specific ideal and an end state ideal. So an ideal that specifies what ideal justice looks like. So part of what, so the idea of saving two promotes imperialism in a variety of ways. I'm going to point out three briefly. The first one is just that the thickness of the ideal plays an epistemic role in blocking the apprehension of unfamiliar instantiations of the ideal. Do I really have three? My timer says five. Three? Okay, I will slow. No, I'm fine with that. I will just reset my timer. So it plays a role in blocking unfamiliar instantiations of the ideal. Finally, and I'm happy to talk about this more in the question and answer period, End state ideals, as has often been pointed out in debates about non-ideal theory, are only particularly helpful in helping us mark out deviations from the ideal. I think this is actually really a problem and the source of a lot of misunderstanding between Western and anti-imperialist feminists. I think anti-imperial, and I've called it ideal theory abuse and some papers about it, wherein I think often what anti-imperialist feminists are claiming is that certain strategies and practices are helpful in ending or reducing sexist oppression in their context, and that they receive the reply that the context is unjust. But this is a category error, right? Like pointing out that the context is unjust, that's why resistance is necessary in the first place, right? We don't evaluate strategies for overcoming injustice by pointing out that the context that they are operating in is unjust. Essentially, and we can just, I don't want to take too much more time, but I won't, if you want to ask me about Okun's comment as an example of it, I'm happy to give it. But effectively, to wrap up, I think that what non-ideal universalism gives us by suggesting that transnational feminism is a justice-enhancing praxis is by discouraging us from using only end-state ideals to evaluate specific strategies for resistance and for overcoming sexist oppression. Instead of pointing out that whole contexts are unjust, what we should be looking at instead is whether specific strategies undertaken under non-ideal conditions promote the end of sexist oppression, and whether that they occur in contexts that are oppressive is beside the point. In fact, the fact that we only need strategies for overcoming sexist oppression in contexts that are already oppressive and unjust. So I think I will just stop here. I have one more slide, but I also explain it on your handout. And I will be happy to take any questions that you have.